This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. How good are you with high-tech gadgets and software? Because if you're really good, the Pentagon could use your help. Last week, it issued a call for brainy ideas on how to fight this war on terrorism. It's looking for proposals for new gizmos to find and root out terrorists, creating special kinds of weapons, a whole laundry list of things. For example, credit card companies today use sophisticated software to identify possible fraud, like red-lighting purchases that don't fit your usual buying habits. The military would like to have a similar system, one, let's say, that might raise flags if someone was buying up the necessary ingredients needed to make a nuclear weapon. Do you think you could design a system that could find those people? Here are some of the wanted items on that list. A system to pick out a face in the crowd or on a video image and then to track the movements of that person as he or she passes from one camera to another. How about this? A device that will instantly translate languages like Pashto and Farsi and Urdu and Arabic. Maybe you've got a device that'll do that. On the list is a portable lie detector that can be used to screen airline passengers. Also, a database for predicting the future action of terrorists. And as for weapons, the Pentagon would like a device that can be mounted on a weapon that can see through rain, snow, fog, or darkness. On the list are devices for detecting and mapping underground tunnels, early warning devices, advanced breaching tools, and a device that can see through walls. These are just a few of the items that, as I say, the Pentagon is looking for. And did I mention this? Oh, yes, they want these devices on the battlefield in 9 to 12 months. So these will have to be developed pretty quickly. So to all of you gadget gurus and computer connoisseurs, here is your challenge. Can you meet this challenge? We're going to be doing a little brainstorming this hour, talking about these ideas. Maybe you have one of your own. Maybe they haven't thought of one that you think would make a good deal for a good tool for the military. And in fact, if you'd like to see the list of the ideas that the military is looking to fulfill, you can go to our website at sciencefriday.com. We'll be picking apart these ideas and putting them past our panel of experts to see what they think about how these things might be accomplished. And if you want to talk about them with us, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK, and you can, as I say, surf over to sciencefriday.com where you'll find that list of ideas, and you can pick and choose and see which one might fit your purposes. And let me introduce my guests. Ray Kurzweil is the president of Kurzweil Technologies in Massachusetts. He's invented a variety of devices from optical character recognition to voice recognition to music synthesizers. He's also author of the book The Age of Spiritual Machines, When Computers Exceed Human Intelligence. Good to have you back on the program. Welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
You're welcome. Nate Lewis is a professor of chemistry at the California Institute of Technology, a.k.a. Caltech in Pasadena, and he works on a variety of technologies, including so-called electronic nose detection systems. Welcome to the program, Nate Lewis.
Thank you.
What do you think of this government request, Nate?
Well, I think it's interesting. They generally fall into three different categories where you might have a call for new ideas. The first would be adaption of existing efforts. For instance, your example of the Farsi dialect speaking. There are automatic speaking recognition systems now. It's just that the high-priority languages that we use for translation were Russian and other dialects, and now coming to the fore are other refocusing places. So there are many items like that. There's a second category in where there are just ongoing needs. The improved algorithms for identifying faces from a video scene for surveillance, people are trying to do that. You could look on a DARPA, the agency that brought you the stealth bomber and the internet, forward-thinking agency, they're always thinking about new algorithms for face recognition for cameras that survey the Super Bowl as well as for finding people in crowds in other locations. So that's just more of what we already know how to do, but do it faster hopefully now maybe than you've been doing before maybe. And the third are really new things that we didn't worry about before, because of the fact that some person will act irrationally, and we never worried about someone carrying a bomb onto a plane with themselves so much because presumably they were going to go down with the plane, and now we worry about that. So now we want screening of passengers for different kinds of threats and new technology adaptions, and get it all here within 12 months, please, fast, thank you.
Boy, that is very short, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah. Ray Kurzweil, what is your reaction?
Well, I've read a number of government RFPs. It read like one that typically would be looking for technology 5 or 10 years out and wanting it in 12 months. Although I think it probably would be feasible if we really do galvanize our top talent. If I focus on some of the areas I'm familiar with, for example, face recognition, that technology has come along. It's already being used in ATM devices. There are now machines that can take multiple pictures of a person as a reference, and then when the same person uses the machine again, it'll actually match her face against the reference pictures. The application that the government has in mind is much more demanding because it has to be with poor lighting, lower resolution, where the angle of view is unpredictable. So the objective would not just be perfect accuracy of identification, but rather making a likely identification and then bringing that situation to the attention of human analysts.
Mm-hmm. And they're also looking, as I read the requirements, they're looking for what's, quote, a real-time application, to be able to do this in real time.
Right. Well, these systems can be very fast. If they have the right information, they can be quite rapid. And even if people try to disguise their faces, it's looking at physiological features that are very difficult to change. Automatic speaker recognition, being able to recognize a particular person from their voice profile, their voice print, which is kind of like a fingerprint because the shape of our vocal tract is unique, and that provides certain frequency cues in the speech signal that can be uniquely identified. Because you have the problem of the poor quality of the audio channel. You've been playing on NPR some samples of conversations from that region of the world, and there's a tremendous amount of background noise. But the background noise doesn't necessarily mask these key features. It's like a smudged fingerprint. You can still identify a particular voice. Being able to understand what people are saying is more challenging, but usually the idea is to actually pick up what's called word spotting, find particular words that might identify a significant conversation so that you can monitor the thousands, tens of thousands of hours of speech that's coming in from all the surveillance and then direct the more relevant conversations to human analysts. And that's been done quite effectively for a lot of languages. As Nate pointed out, we don't have a lot of expertise in Urdu and Pashto and Farsi and so on, and that's part of the problem. We need to get linguistics expertise and a lot of other expertise in these languages.
Mm-hmm. Nate?
I agree with that. I want to interject just one more point about, say, the face recognition challenge as it needs to be adapted to the terrorist problem. There's a big difference in technical capability between verification, validation, and identification. In other words, you go up to an ATM and you say, this is who I am. Does the computer agree that the picture in the database that claims to be me is indeed the picture it's seeing now of me? So it looks up and matches against you and says, yes, that's probably you. It's a very different thing to go scanning around the crowd in the Super Bowl and to scan everybody and then say, go see whether any of these people and any of their faces are a close match against the top 100 people on the FBI wanted list. The odds of it finding someone that looks like the twin brother of the neighbor next door who happens to look like X are much higher in that. And so the validation versus the search problem of go find and track the terrorist potential people in a crowd.
It's absolutely more
technically challenging problem.
It's absolutely more difficult. On the other hand, I don't think the expectation would be that these systems work perfectly. It really would be to, if you imagine a situation where there are dozens or hundreds of surveillance cameras, it's not really possible for human analysts to observe them all and to keep everybody's image in mind. So the system would bring potential situations to the attention of human analysts who could then study them more carefully. So the systems would not expect it to be perfect accuracy.
How much of any off-the-shelf systems could be rejiggered to do these things? You know, when NASA was asked to retool itself a few years ago, they went to the smaller, faster, cheaper method. Can you take off-the-shelf things and they did and rejigger them?
You have to really modify them substantially for these applications. This application is so specific and so demanding, it actually requires going beyond the state of the art, which is not impossible with a concerted effort. I mean, if we think in terms of the spirit of the Manhattan Project, these things mm-hmm. are feasible, but that's really what we're talking about.
You agree, Nate?
Oh, yeah, I agree in most of those things, that it's beyond the state of the art to do some of the things. For instance, monitor caves is now a new kind of requirement because we believe that people are hiding in caves. We've had a desire to monitor things underground where people might hide stuff for quite a long time, and now we're changing the scope to don't make it a big building that might be underground, just get us a small cave underground. How do we do that now? And so some of them, I don't think you could expect reasonably to do much more than have a conceptual breakthrough within the next 12 to 18 months and demonstrate that there might be a path to actually solving the problem. Other ones, you could adapt existing technologies, say the Farsi problem of speech recognition, and you'd make good insight in headway into those in the 12 to 18 month period. So I think one needs to balance the wish of what you want to have tomorrow versus what you're actually going to have tomorrow in some broad perspective.
On the other hand, there are some things we can do with technology we know that works, which would eliminate a lot of the vulnerabilities we have. And these are only obliquely relevant to the DOD RFP. For example, there was this idea that came from a colleague of mine in Silicon Valley, Steve Kirsch, which would really effectively eliminate the motivation for hijacking an airplane, which is the idea of having a hijack mode, which any of the crew or air traffic controllers can put the airplane in, and once it's in that mode, the pilots no longer have control, whether they're the legitimate pilots or the hijackers. The plane's put on autopilot, directed from the ground to an appropriate airport, which landed automatically, and the majority of our landings already are the so-called landing by wire. And this is actually, I got interested in it, I put it on a website I have for ideas like this, and brought it to the attention of the head of the National Academy of Engineers. He brought it to the Secretary of Transportation, who put it in the plan, and it's in the plan now, but now the airlines say it's too expensive. And, of course, that's a key problem. This really shouldn't be a matter of competitive cost pressures, but should be a matter of national security. But this plan could work. There are some technical issues. It would cost billions of dollars, but it would eliminate the motivation to hijack an airplane, which is to commandeer it, whether you want to use it as a missile or the old-fashioned terrorism of bringing it to Cuba or some other place. If you can't commandeer the airplane, you don't really have much motivation to hijack it. We need to do the same thing with trucks. We could have trucks register their intended course, particularly if they're a hazmat truck. The truck would be tracked with GPS, and if it diverts from its intended course, the truck obviously wouldn't be driven by autopilot, but it would basically be disabled with some warning so it doesn't get in an accident. And then the hijacker who's taken over the truck would no longer be able to operate it.
Mm-hmm. They do that with nuclear waste, don't they, right now, when they're moving it around?
I don't think that we have this system in place for hazmat.
All right. We're going to take a short break and let you scratch your heads a little bit, think ideas you might be able to come up with to match our experts, Ray Kurzweil and Nate Lewis. So sit back and relax for just a moment. We're going to take, a short break and come back with more ideas for meeting the Pentagon's challenge of developing technologies to root out terrorists and keep track of what's going on around us. So stay with us. We'll be right back after the short break. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the Pentagon proposals for combating terrorism, creating new weapons, looking for companies, individuals, to come up with ideas for combating, as I say, terrorists, and then coming up with new weapons and finding where they might be hiding out, and looking for your help. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Our guests are Ray Kurzweil, President of Kurzweil Technologies in Massachusetts, and Nate Lewis, Professor of Chemistry at California Institute of Technology, Caltech. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Another section of the request by the Pentagon has to do with psychological. They call it reducing the support and infrastructure of terrorist organizations through psychological operations and civil affairs. And they describe it as reducing popular support and credibility of the terrorist organizations, and in training and equipping indigenous professional military units to fight terrorists. Is this psychological warfare they're talking about? Gentlemen, have any idea?
Well, I think we could start with just getting some people who are familiar with the languages and the culture and these societies who can effectively make our case and beam that to by radio to populations, be more effective in delivering our message around the world, and including the Arab world. I don't know that that's a technology issue so much as a cultural and communication issue.
We were talking before a bit about, I think, Nate, you mentioned that the Pentagon is looking for ways of seeing things underground. And actually one of the proposals they're looking for is something that will see through walls. But don't we have systems now that by looking down from satellites you can see underground and you know, used by the oil industry and by archaeologists and people like that?
We do use sonar, radar, and other electromagnetic means, vibration analysis, particularly if we can get as close to the location as possible, that can give us some idea of what's down there and distinguish an empty cave from one that might have trucks and storage means. We have apparently identified arm caches below, and those have been blown up. But small bands of terrorists with small supplies is more challenging.
Mm-hmm. Nate, one of the things that they're also looking for is new bomb sniffing, chemical warfare sniffing devices, and even things that can sniff the pathogen or the chemical before it's even released. Is that possible?
Right. Some of that's possible, and again, would be a refocusing of priorities toward targets. We weren't particularly worried about one person walking on an airplane with white powder before, for instance, and now witness all the scares. We want to know what every coffee creamer spill is, and it's all suspect. So that's certainly something that would be a redirection of existing efforts to detect large quantities, but to portableize it to make them small, lightweight, and low power. So it helps reprioritize which technologies you might actually use compared to what you thought of before.
Mm-hmm.
Let me point out one more thing here. I think that technology is clearly, like this psychological issue, not the only thing that's important here. You know, the Pentagon often will get into a mode of, we want to fix this whole problem with technological high-tech gizmos, and yet you have to balance that against simple things of if you, instead of putting the airplane in autopilot to land, which pilots may not ever want to do with their plane, of improving cockpit doors, of improving physical security, and of doing things like ensuring that people that get on the plane are supposed to be on the plane. If you do some things, terrorists are a moving threat, and they will try to find the weaknesses in the other things. We can bring up the level with technology, but it's not the cure-all, that's for certain.
Just to follow up on the idea of making sure that we got the right people boarding airplanes and other vehicles, that would not be unreasonable to use retina and iris scans. And unlike voice prints, which are quite somewhat variable, iris and retina scans are extremely accurate, even more so than fingerprint. They look at the pattern of blood vessels in the retina and the pattern of flecks on the iris, and it could be done in a few seconds, less time than it takes now to ask those security questions, and could give us a very high level of confidence that we know what people are entering a vehicle or other secure area.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go to the phones. Lucinda in Phoenix. Hi, Lucinda.
Hi.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Well, my suggestion is goes along with that psychological aspect. I've, for many years, been frustrated with a government that has so much access to so much knowledge and uses it so poorly in the social sciences arena. I mean, these people are coming from societies that have economic problems, that have systemic social problems, And I don't know, I mean, how much technology do you want to pay for to try to get into someone's mind? I mean, this is as much a war of the mind, in my thinking, as it is a technological one.
Yeah, I would agree that technology is not the first line with regard to what you're referring to. I mean, we need real expertise and knowledge of these societies for a lot of reasons, to understand the politics and also to get our message out in an effective way and just to understand what's going on, and particularly in the public relations war, we're struggling, apparently.
Well, and that's my point. I'm a former linguist, and I can understand the difficulties of language. I mean, identifying a word, and there's a very good book by an anthropologist, Edward T. Hall, that was called Beyond Culture, and he deals with issues of language and context. I mean, these people talk to each other a lot. Maybe they're not using a word that we would recognize, but they all understand what it means. So there's a problem there in just identifying words, for instance.
But I think some of the Department of Defense requests here is specifically to zero in on intercepted conversations of terrorists or suspected terrorists to understand what's being said. I mean, we intercept thousands of conversations or tens of thousands. There needs to be some automated means of determining which ones need further follow-up by human analysts, and that's what these systems are directed at.
Could you not just key on certain key words instead of translating the whole conversation?
Well, that's in fact what's done. It's called word spotting. Mm-hmm. The systems are not good enough with all the background noise to give perfect transcription, so they look for certain words. Then, of course, you have to keep in mind that the terrorists are talking in code words and using code terms, so you need some human intelligence to understand what words you're looking for.
Lucinda, thanks for calling.
Well, thank you.
Have you thought about being a translator?
Well, yeah. I'd have to learn Arabic, but it's doable. It's doable, anything else.
You must be a quick study.
By necessity.
All right, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Did you want to say something there, Nate?
Well, let me just add one point. I think that her point about understanding the culture is important not only for the economic and social values, but also certainly recently it's come to the fore that the intelligence communities have been criticized for placing out of balance efforts onto high technology gizmos as opposed to humans on the ground learning about the culture and whispering into somebody's ear that September 11th is coming and something's up. And there's no replacement for the human knowledge, and it's incredibly valuable, so we really need to think about the mix between those two that we have in the community. Mm-hmm.
But most of if you look at the proposals here that the Pentagon has put out, only maybe one or two of all the dozens of proposals have to do with, you know, the psychological aspect of this or the cultural aspect.
Or the human thing. Right. And that's my point here, is that there certainly has been now more discussion in the popular press and among people at Capitol Hill about the relative importance of these two and how you really ought to balance them.
Right. I mean, this is a technology RFP, so I wouldn't assume that this is the sum total of the DoD's effort in this area.
Well, let's talk a little bit more technology. The battlefield sniffers are looking for a lot of battlefield chemical sniffers that can identify chemical and biological weapons quickly. Nate, how fast can we make those?
Oh, you could make something that did the chemical weapons identification pretty fast, within 12 to 18 months. I think that's a requirement if you wanted a handheld or even chip-sized sniffing device that, with some resources and focus, one with existing technologies could do that. The biological weapons is a different story because we don't have any good technologies now on the shelf to do the sampling and finding the particles. Once you found the particles and can break them open and examine their DNA, then a few hours later you can determine whether or not it's a biological weapon. But doing the collection and the physical harvesting of these things at small amounts from the air is something that we could do, but we haven't done and really ought to deserve attention.
I mean, there are chip-based detectors detectors that can detect thousands or tens of thousands of different DNA or genetic fingerprints and could very quickly identify possible biological pathogens. The problem is the pathogens are wrapped in a spore that otherwise looks just like a dust particle. But there is equipment that could break it down quickly. I mean, I think this is feasible. You know, these things take time, but with an urgent effort, there's technology that can detect biological pathogens pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Charles in St. Paul. Hi, Charles.
Hi.
I'm Chris. I'm sorry. Yes.
No worries. I know that the Brits actually have a face recognition software that they use in a lot of their towns because they have a lot more camera systems in their towns, and they actually use it to spot soccer hooligans at their for soccer matches and stuff like that. All real time. I don't know why the United States doesn't start looking other places like England's probably 3 years ahead in the closed circuit camera industry because
yeah,
they use it in all their towns.
That's true. So. I mean, England has been lots of public spaces are under surveillance in England, and they have been developing automated means of doing this for several years. So I think you have a good point.
And also for gas sniffers, I worked in the military. I was in the Canadian military for about 5 years, and we had a form of the sniffers, and they never really put up with a lot of the rigors that you put them through in combat. So, you know, it would be easy with today's technology to throw it together, but I really don't think it would stand the battlefield, really, because it would take so much testing. They're expecting to get stuff out and ready for the field in a year. And it just won't last. All they're going to have is constant problems, and it's just going to hamper the troops in so many ways that it'll actually become a burden more than anything else.
Right. That's an important point. Right now, the acquisition time for a new weapon system or even a new technology to be actually used by troops in the field compared to when it was prototyped must be 5 to 10 years at minimum in most cases because of all the hardening that you need so that when the red light goes on, it really means that something is out there and it's not a false alarm. And it's used in daytime and humid conditions. So there's a big gap, and closing that gap is generally very hard or very expensive. So I think the 12 to 18 month call leads to existing technologies being adapted somehow as opposed to really new things happening and being employed on this time scale.
Well, how long did it take us to for the Manhattan Project to build an atom bomb? I mean, that was certainly not 5 to 10 years. So things can be done on an urgent basis, and we do have the incipient technologies for a lot of these applications. They need to be optimized for these applications, and in some cases the state of the art needs to be extended, but if there's enough money and focus on it, a lot of these goals, I think, are feasible.
I'm Ira Flato, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I think is the Pentagon, I didn't read it carefully enough to see if there's a budget limitation, but I didn't see one on it, on these proposals.
Right. Nor was there an overall budget associated with the proposals either. So the way I read this is the Pentagon is looking for any sets of good new ideas, which is very appropriate, and depending on the number that they get, they'll try to put together a package and then try to get the good ideas funded, as opposed to the other way around, where they've carved out a certain amount of money. They don't know how much money it will take, and there'll be a given play take here between the ideas.
How possible is it that some of these things already exist in a rival agency, like the CIA, and the Pentagon doesn't know they even exist?
That's possible. I mean, for example, there's a lot in here about decryption and steganography, which is trying to detect images that might be on the web that have invisible secret messages interlaced in them. That's an area that the National Security Agency has been very active in, and the NSA has the most powerful decryption technology that we have. So it's very possible that they have some things that could help.
Mm-hmm. And how do you look at this as sort of this proposal as sort of a double-edged sword? On the one hand, you're looking for new technologies, but on the other hand, you have to admit that you haven't developed these over the years.
Well, that's the whole dilemma, not just with this proposal, but in society in general. I mean, we have so many vulnerabilities, and you see them discussed in the press, and a terrorist could read the front page of the New York Times and get a lot of ideas on things they may not have thought of. On the other hand, an open society like ours, a democratic society, needs discussion, and we need public RFP processes and so on in order to address these issues and close these vulnerabilities, and it's a real basic dilemma.
Yeah, but I think that you can't afford not to do it, in the sense of, if you take the attitude of that they're always going to go somewhere else and will always be vulnerable, which is correct, and you don't do anything about it, then you never raise the baseline level of security that you have living every day toward the common things. And you have to do some of that on a continuous basis, so that although you can't ever guard against the craziest person doing the lowest probability event, you can, on average, make it significantly harder for them to do it.
Yeah, I agree. I think each one of the vulnerabilities you can describe, there is a viable solution to it and a way of closing that vulnerability. And we need to put a lot more resources into doing that, particularly with the observation that technology is accelerating. It's getting more powerful. I mean, these terrorists commandeered 50-year-old technology of jet planes and skyscrapers. The new technologies like bioengineered pathogens is far more powerful. But there's also tremendous benefit from biotechnology. We need to put comparable energy into developing these defensive technologies from these new scenarios that are emerging.
What strikes you as the hardest technology to develop in these proposals that they've put out? Anyone that just stands out and saying, boy, this would take more than 9 to 12 months to get on the battlefield? Or are they all very, very difficult?
Well, they're all kind of open-ended.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think of steganography or decryption, I mean, that's just an ongoing battle. The encryption technology and the decrypting technology are both rapidly advancing, and it's a constant sort of conflict that will go on indefinitely. Things like speech recognition, face recognition, it's not a check item that you have it. I mean, it continually needs to get more and more powerful, and it can be as we get more powerful computers and the science of doing this advances.
So all right. Well, I'm going to have to interrupt because we have to take a short break and come back and talk lots more with Ray Kurzweil and Nate Lewis about new. Is that good? No. Well, we're going to have to say goodbye. That's right. We have another segment. I'm sorry, gentlemen. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Nate Lewis, professor of chemistry, Caltech. Ray Kurzweil, president of Kurzweil Technologies in Massachusetts. I'm losing my mind today. Don't go away. We'll be right back and talk about new operating systems. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This hour, we're going to talk about new products for your computers, your home computer, your PC, your Macintosh. And, you know, this as new products, people know, this has not been the best time for the introduction of a new product. Our minds are on other things these days, but last week Microsoft started selling its new operating system, Windows XP, and joining me now to talk about the new operating system and how it stacks up to others on the market, like Apple's OS X, or OS X if you prefer, is David Pogue. He writes the State of the Art column in the New York Times Circuits section, and he's also an author of many computing books. Welcome to Science Friday, David.
Thanks a lot.
You've had a chance to fool around with Windows XP. What do you think of it?
Oh, I've been immersed in it up to my neck. It's definitely the best Windows there's ever been, but that's quite a loaded statement.
How loaded?
Well, it doesn't necessarily imply how good old Windows used to be. So the thing they did is they stacked the best they could do visually on top of the most stable Windows they used to have, which is Windows 2000. So in effect, they've merged their home and the corporate versions of Windows to create XP. So if you're used to any other kind of Windows, you'll see it mostly as an improvement, especially in stability. It really does truly go for weeks or months without requiring a system crash restart, as opposed to, some would say, minutes or hours within Windows Me, for example.
Mm-hmm. And what are the downsides to it?
The downsides mostly have more to do with requirements and policy. So the requirements for this thing are pretty staggering. It needs 2 gigabytes of disk space just for the operating system.
Hmm.
It really likes 128 megabytes of memory or much more if it can get it. And overall, Microsoft recommends that you install it only on a very young PC. They say 2 years old or younger. I would say, you know, even younger than that if you don't want to have to do a lot of updating. That's the requirement side of it. And then, of course, the other issue is the policy side, and that's things like this is the first Windows that is copy protected. So if you try to install the same CD on another PC, like your notebook computer, you will find yourself, after 30 days, locked out of your own machine, and you'll be required to either connect to Microsoft via the Internet or call them on a toll-free number to explain your case, and they'll probably tell you, well, wait a minute, you're supposed to buy a new copy for every machine you own. Not that that's illegal or anything different than the license agreement has always said, but it is a change that they're enforcing it now, and a lot of people are very unhappy about that.
Now, a little bit before Windows, a new Windows system was introduced, Macintosh came out with a new system, OS 10. It sort of happened, but a little more people were listening. How does that compare to Windows?
Well, that's a really good question. Overall, taken together, they really make 2001 look like the year of the stable operating system, because Apple did much the same thing. Apple grafted its very attractive, good-looking front end onto a proven undercarriage, which in this case is Unix. So that's the operating system that's been driving, you know, universities and a lot of corporations and institutions for years. It's been polished within an inch of its life. So this operating system, too, is very, very stable and very, very good-looking. You know, the truth is, I've been a Mac fan for a long time, but of course I go both ways. I have both computers on my desk and use both operating systems regularly. OS 10.1, to my mind, is a better operating system in almost every way. The little nips and tucks, the design touches, the simplicity, the shearing away of a lot of techno-ridiculous stuff that Microsoft's engineers have piled on over the years. But, of course, the one big drawback to the Mac, as always, is applications. So that is the software you can get for it. Software library for the Mac is still a fraction of the size of what you can get in Windows, which is why, you know, Windows still predominates in corporate America.
But does that mean you can't get the basic things that you need to run your office or your home software from the Macintosh?
No, absolutely not. Yeah, I should clarify that the basic stuff is all there in force. For example, Microsoft Office just this week came out in a Mac OS 10 version, which is extremely beautiful and a delight to use, filled with the things that make OS 10 so cool, like transparency and little animations and drop shadows and just a feeling that you're working like in the world of the Toy Story movies, you know, a computer-generated world, you know, and all the web browsers and email programs and most of the graphics and web design programs you could ever need. But you know, every party I go to, I hear, oh, so you're a Mac fan. Yeah. Well, you know, I'm a Beekeeper, and Beekeeper Pro is only available for Windows. You know, what can I say? Well, a Windows machine is right for you then.
Yeah.
But Apple swears up and down that because programmers are so excited about OS X and the Unix underpinnings, that there will be a forthcoming flood of programs that may begin to turn that situation around.
All right, let me go to the phone and see if we can get a question or two in. Let's go to Kevin in Phoenix. Hi, Kevin.
Hi there. I got a question and a comment.
Go ahead.
Number one is, how do you feel about the security issues in giving up so much information? I've heard that it requires quite a bit.
What is it?
XP.
Okay.
That really doesn't sit well with me. Some people were saying you require to cough up a credit card number just to register the software. And the second one is, why are we keep having so much reliance on Windows? We need to actually break out of that, I feel. But that is so slow in coming.
Those are two great questions. The first question is, no credit card number is required. There are a number of different ways that Microsoft tries to pry information out of you. All of them are optional. So the first thing that has people upset is the activation, when you first install Windows XP. This is not a case when you buy a new computer with XP on it. You don't have to do it then. But if you're upgrading, your computer does make a call to Microsoft. It does not reveal anything about you. It just tells them what your computer has on it. It says, here is a computer with 128 megs of RAM and a 20-gig hard drive. Okay. So your name. However, there are XP features. One of the coolest is this thing called Windows Messenger, which is sort of like an instant messaging chat program, except that it adds voice and even video so that you and I could have a video conference across the world. And features like this require you, yes, to give Microsoft your name and address and information to sign up for this thing called a Microsoft Passport, which Hotmail users have been aware of for some time. So there's a couple other cases where they say, if you give us this information, then we'll give you some new features. Mm. So, but it is all optional.
Mm-hmm.
The other question is, why is the world so dependent on Windows when many feel that, you know, there are the superior alternatives? It simply has to do with, in my mind, an accident of history, which is Bill Gates being in the right time when IBM needed an operating system for its new PCs. And ever since then, what happens is corporate America buys Windows machines, you know, by the hundreds of thousands. You and I could argue the merits forever, saying, you know, well, for what I want at home is what's the best, you know. So, but right now, what people who buy computers and corporations care about is, will I lose my job by going out on a limb and buying something radical? In other words, the snowball just keeps rolling and rolling now, and especially now that the government has pretty much given up on breaking up the monopolistic practices of Microsoft. I don't see any change in that coming soon.
Mm-hmm. How does it stack up with the third operating system that gets even less attention, which is Linux?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Linux is still a very geeky sort of programmer's operating system. It has a lot of wonderful features to it, but you know, there's no Microsoft Word for Linux.
Yeah.
So in a way, what you're describing is Mac OS X, because that is the Unix underpinnings with a beautiful front end that everyday ordinary people can use, and things like Microsoft Office and, you know, FileMaker and Internet Explorer and all the cool programs already available.
So when you buy Mac OS X, there's a Linux like program running underneath it that you don't see?
It is in fact Unix, yes, uh-huh. Indeed. And what's really amazing, I'm actually working on a book on Mac OS X, and I've been teaching myself how to use the little program called Terminal that comes with it, which shows you the Unix pulsing underneath. I mean, typing codes and having it spew codes back at you.
But David, isn't that a step backwards, though? Why aren't we supposed to make computers simpler, more graphical user interface instead of having now? I remember typing that stuff 10 years ago and saying, like, there's got to be a better way.
Well, it's the irony of the millennium, isn't it? This is Apple's whole thing. It's like, you don't need to memorize commands. That's antiquated.
Right.
But of
and
course,
so what do they do then? They put this terminal under there that you have to type these little arcane things.
Well, I must tell you, it's extremely buried. I mean, it's in a folder and a folder and a folder, and it's just for the geeks who like that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So most people will never even know it's there.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, Apple has certainly lost the megahertz war, as they say, you know, because the Intel chips are much faster than the Motorola chips that Apple uses, but they may not... Faster in terms of megahertz speed, but not possibly processing speed.
Right. Well, I thought you were trying to play a trick question on me. That's right. Megahertz are not created equal between different chips. The megahertz ratings are irrelevant. So you cannot say that a 500 megahertz Pentium is the same as a 500 megahertz Macintosh. It's the same as RPM in a car engine. You know, a 1,000 RPM in a Volkswagen Beetle has a very different effect than in a Mack truck. So for very technical reasons, it's safe to compare megahertz ratings only within the same chip family.
Let me just remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatto, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. And we're talking with David Pogue, who writes the computer column in the New York Times Circuit section every Thursday. Any great gadgets you've come across lately?
Well, the coolest gadget of the week has got to be, speaking of Apple, the iPod, its first consumer electronic non-computer gizmo in a long, long time. It's an MP3 player about the size of a deck of cards or a pager, a little bigger than a pager. And basically, you've been, in the past, been able to buy MP3 players of this size, but they could only hold a few songs. Or you could buy one with a hard drive inside that holds 1,000 songs or something, but those are massive, like the size of a, you know, cottage cheese container. So this thing is the best of both. It's a very small thing with a 5-gigabyte hard drive in there that can hold 1,300 songs.
Wow.
Which is a lot. And it has two other things that distinguish it. One is that it connects only to the Macintosh at this point with a FireWire cable, which is to say about 30 times faster than regular MP3 players. So in my test, I could download an entire CD's worth of music onto this thing in about 6 seconds.
6 seconds for a whole CD.
Something
wow.
would take you, way longer.
Hey, well, you would think that Apple would realize the bonanza if they could make a Windows version of this.
I believe they're working on that even now. They wanted to do the Mac first, but I wouldn't be surprised if they made it Windows compatible, for next year.
Mm-hmm.
And the other remarkable thing, by the way, is that it's also a hard drive. So if you just connect it to your Macintosh, it shows up on the desktop as a disk, and you can just copy files on it for transport.
You can put it in your pocket, take it with you.
Pretty neat.
Well, David, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
We'll have to have you come back and talk more computer stuff with us.
That'd be great.
Take care.
Thanks.
Thanks for joining us. David Pogue is a state-of-the-art columnist for the New York Times in the Science Times sections and Circuit sections on Thursday. And earlier we spoke with Ray Kurzweil, president of Kurzweil Technologies in Massachusetts, author of the book The Age of Spiritual Machines, When Computers Exceed Human Intelligence, and Nate Lewis, professor of chemistry at Caltech in Pasadena, California. Mike Cullen is our technical director. Our own engineers are William O'Neill and Irene Trudell in New York. Bob Boylan composed our theme music. We had help today from NPR librarians Key Molesky and Alphonse Vinn. And if you have comments or questions, and if you missed any of the references we made to all those new Pentagon technology things, go surf over to our website at www.sciencefriday.com. And you can also leave us some email and suggest your own James Bond sort of stuff that we might not have had time to talk about this hour. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.
Science Friday is produced by National Public Radio and Samana Productions in association with member station WNYC New York. The views expressed are not necessarily those of NPR, the underwriters, or this broadcast station. For tapes and transcripts, call toll-free 1-877-NPR-TEXT. That's 1-877-NPR-8398.